I couldn't scream loud enough. There's nothing I could do to make it go away or to make them stop. I didn't.
Are you okay talking about this?
Can we take a break?
Mia Khalifa.
Mia Khalifa.
Mia Khalifa.
Mia Khalifa.
I'm Sarah. I'm Sarah f***ing Joe.
Sarah Joe.
The former adult film star.
Now business owner and social media activist.
With over 50 million followers.
Where should this story start?
I lived through a lot of conflict in Lebanon, and then I moved to America, and I was bullied for being Middle Eastern. It was around the time of 9/11. That was pretty difficult. Made a lot of choices that I can't take back.
Your husband, when you're 18 years old, is encouraging you towards the adult entertainment industry. What did they stand to gain from that?
Fetishization. I fucked up because I signed a contract that says in perpetuity on it. Do you know how dangerous and predatory that is?
When was your anxiety at its highest?
The company going after me publicly. The major production companies prey on vulnerable young women. Didn't shower, didn't brush my teeth, didn't eat, didn't leave my bed. It's following me for the rest of my life. But I am not the sum of the things I've been through or the adversities I've faced.
For people that are really struggling, how did you get out of that phase? Quick one before this episode starts. About 75% of people that listen to this podcast on audio platforms, Spotify and Apple, haven't yet hit the follow button. If I could ask a favor from you, if you've ever enjoyed this podcast, please could you just go and hit that follow button on your app? It helps this show more than I could possibly say. And the bigger the show gets, the better the guests get. Thank you and enjoy this conversation. Where should this story start? Where does your story start? What is the most sort of pertinent moment that you recall from your memory that has shaped the woman that is sat in front of me today?
It honestly feels like the last year or two. That's where my life started and where I should start, because the woman that's in front of you right now has been a work in progress and is still a work in progress. And I feel like I've been my most authentic and purest form of myself in the past year or two. Like, the closer to today we get, the more secure I feel in who I am and who that person is. But obviously there was a lot of other things that happened to get me to this point. But to answer that question, like a year or two.
Let's start at the end then, which is today.
Yeah.
Why? The closer we are to today, the more authentic you feel to yourself. Why?
I'm going after the things I actually want, and I'm growing into my confidence and the self-assurance that I've gained from doing the things I love and accomplishing my goals has formed who I am. And it feels really good, and it feels very validating, and it's just... It's never clicked before, and they always say, like, oh, the confidence is the key to everything. Confidence will unlock everything for you. And I never really understood that, because it's like, okay, where the fuck does the confidence come from? How do you just simply get confident? And I have grown to realize that confidence comes from just accomplishing things that you want to accomplish and being proud of yourself. And that pride makes you feel confident. Like, I feel confident even when I mess up now, whereas if I messed up 5, 6, 10 years ago, it would send me into a pit of shame, a really unhealthy, just downward spiral that would get me nowhere.
Did you ever imagine being here? Did you ever imagine being in the state you currently are today, happiness, confidence, et cetera, et cetera? And I don't want to put words in your mouth there in terms of the word happiness, but the place you are today, over the last 10 years, did you imagine you would get to this point, or did this seem unimaginable?
It seemed unimaginable for a while, but my mental health was also not as strong as it is today. There was a lot of periods in my life where I couldn't see past 48 hours, let alone 10 years. It was very day to day for a while. And I think that's why I'm so confident, because right now, if you ask me what I can see in 10 years, I feel like I can answer that. I know what I want. I know what my goals are and what I want to accomplish. So Yeah. Even in interviews 5 years ago, when they would ask me, where do you see yourself in 5 years? I would always say, I have no fucking clue. I don't know where I see myself next week.
And what changed?
Taking risks, honestly. Just taking a few risks here and there and seeing them play out for the better and learning from my mistakes and learning what I want and saying no to a lot of things to get to what I want, like job opportunities and things that didn't really align with what I thought I wanted in a year or two or 5 years or even 10 years as like my confidence started to grow and I started to actually see life plans for myself. Taking risks and walking away from those risks, either having them play out for the better or learning from the mistakes and learning, oh, this didn't work. This is what I need to do next time. Oh, this didn't work. I crossed a boundary of mine and now I don't feel good. Now I know this is past where I should be pushing myself. A lot of trial and error.
Confidence. Confidence is a through line throughout your story. Take me back to your earliest memories of lacking in confidence.
Yeah.
And where, because, you know, I came to this country from Botswana in Africa when I was a young boy. And I struggled. I think we both struggled with being accepted by the culture we had arrived in. Me in Plymouth, only black kid, curly hair, trying to figure out why my hair's not straight, relaxing it chemically all the time. Why we're the only black family in this all white school, et cetera, et cetera. And then that battle with like the lack of enoughness, not feeling like I was enough and what I did to try and make myself feel like I was enough. But take me back to your story at the earliest moment where you struggled with not feeling like you were enough or confident enough.
I mean, it's not even coming to America. It's being in Lebanon. There was colorism there. I was the darkest one in my family. There was colorism at the school that I was at. I felt like a bit of an outsider because I was darker than what the beauty standard for a Lebanese girl is, which is lighter skin, olive undertones, dark hair, green eyes. Like that's the epitome of a beautiful woman in Lebanon. And then I moved to America and that just got, it went to the extreme side of that. I was definitely one of the darkest kids. I was bullied for being Middle Eastern. It was around the time of 9/11. That was pretty difficult, especially since it was in Washington, D.C., and Washington, D.C. was heavily impacted by 9/11. The Pentagon was hit. New York is not that far from us. It's about 4 hours. Like, so many people in my school either had family and parents that worked at the Pentagon. It was a lot of bullying that then turned into internalized racism. And all I wanted to do from then forward, like you said, you wanted to relax your hair. You wanted to assimilate and fit in. I also wanted the same thing. And I just held that in and it turned into internalized racism.
How did that go? Because I often reflect and I think it's taken me time to look back in hindsight and realize what I was feeling versus in the moment, you're kind of just in a state of like, defense. It's like, how do I get through today? How do I get these people to like me? Versus, you know, and I look back and think, no, man, you had so much shame. Like you were carrying around shame and insecurity. How did that girl at that time, how old are you at this point? 7, 10, 11?
8, 9.
Okay. And how were you aware of your feelings? I guess is the question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very much so. I think, yeah, I've always been an introvert and very aware of what I was going through and angsty. And even like going into my teen years, I've always been aware of the fact that what I was feeling is shame, or what I was feeling is I'm not feeling like I'm enough. I feel like, I've always been aware of that feeling. There was also confusion with it. But I think self-awareness has been prevalent the whole time.
What was your relationship like with yourself in those teen years?
I was very hard on myself. I was very angry at myself for not fitting in and for not being a certain way. And just I did not like myself. I didn't like the reflection in the mirror, and me not liking the reflection in the mirror obviously affected my confidence, my self-esteem, everything. So in turn, I also didn't like the choices that I was making, which made me not only hate the reflection, but hate the person that I was with at the end of the day.
The choices you're making.
Yeah. I think insecurity leads you to do things for validation that you otherwise wouldn't if you were secure in yourself, or if you respected yourself, or if you loved yourself.
Like relationship choices?
Relationship choices, lifestyle choices, anything.
What are some of those? So in the context of relationships, from doing this conversation with multiple people, I've started to sort of piece dots together around, if your self-esteem is lacking, you might become a people pleaser.
Yeah.
In your work. So you might, you know, be exploited by your work, and you might not get what you deserve in your job. Is there anything else that you've seen as a symptom or a consequence of having real low self-esteem that people might be able to relate to? Like for you,
so much. It's such a broad spectrum, because you can either turn into a people pleaser or you can turn into an insufferable. A people pleaser on the surface level, everyone loves a people pleaser. They want to please everybody.
Mm.
But the downside of a people pleaser is they want to please everybody. They have no boundaries with themselves or with other people. They don't respect their own boundaries. They don't respect others' boundaries. If they're people-pleasing person A and what person B wants goes against what person A wants, they will find a way to please both of them. So a people-pleaser also turns into someone who lies, someone who deceives, someone who is a habitual boundary crosser with themselves and with other people. Like there's a spectrum to it. I would say I was definitely a people pleaser. I also sought validation from people who's looking back on it now, whose opinion I probably shouldn't have respected back then, let alone today. So that was a downside. Made a lot of choices that I can't take back, porn being one of the biggest ones, but I feel like that wasn't even the first one. The first one was getting into a relationship that I never should have been in with someone who was extremely abusive, extremely dangerous, in the sense that looking back on it and having the self-awareness and being able to call it what it was is grooming. It was just a relationship that I feel like a lot of girls get into when they're in their late teens.
Why does that happen?
What do you mean?
Getting into a relationship when you're roughly 18 years old, wasn't it?
The relationship started when I was 16.
Okay.
Then went until I was about 20.
And this person was significantly older than you?
Yes. Yes. The age difference had a play in that dynamic. My low self-esteem had a play in that dynamic. Everything was just kind of like...
16?
Yeah.
This person's double your age?
No. It was about a 10-year age difference.
Okay. And at 16, when you looked forward to your future... Had you asked yourself that question about, you know, what happens in 10 years' time?
Would you have had an answer? No, I wouldn't have known what happened in a week's time. It was, I mean, I got talked into eloping to Las Vegas 4 days after my 18th birthday. So if you asked me where I see myself in 5 years, I don't know. I would have looked at you with doe eyes and said, I don't know. And then looked over at him. Where do you see me in 5 years? Like, I didn't have a sense of self, so I attached myself to someone who was more than happy to abuse that, and someone who could see that and see someone easily manipulatable.
Yeah.
But at the same time, eager to please. So, yeah, it was just the perfect storm.
Perfect storm.
Yeah.
You got married at 18.
Yeah.
Even that is uncommon, to say the least.
Yeah. Do not recommend it.
So when you say that this you know, this person clearly took advantage of several things that were present in you, whether that was low self-esteem or, you know, just general inexperience and naivety of being a young woman. Which direction in life did they push you towards? Did they push you towards becoming a really good partner to them, or did they push you in a professional direction, or did they pull you towards themselves?
Yeah, it was. There was no encouragement. There was no pushing towards anything. It was an extremely unhealthy relationship, and I even feel weird calling it a relationship because the dynamic was not one of a relationship. It was more one of someone who saw a toy to play with. The industry they were in is probably not the one that you're thinking of. They were in the army. So it wasn't even, it had nothing to do with the porn industry, but it also had everything to do with it. They were the ones who kind of put that whole world in front of me and encouraged it. And
they encouraged it.
Oh, very much so.
Your husband.
Yeah.
I struggle to understand this. So your husband, when you're 18 years old, is encouraging you towards the adult entertainment industry?
It started off as just online. But then eventually, yeah, when I was asked to I was given a business card and told to think about it. I went home, I laughed it off, and the consensus was, you should do it. I think it would be great. That's what I mean.
Okay, so you're, I read this story. You were out at lunch somewhere. A guy walks up to you when you're how old?
20.
And gives you a business card and says, if you ever want to consider getting into the adult entertainment industry, here's my number. You take that home. I was wondering this when I read about that part of your story. What happened post that business card? You know, because I was thinking, well, she was married, so... You know, I've got a partner. My girlfriend comes home and says, a man's come up to me in the street and given me a card and made me an offer like that. I'm going to be honest, my natural disposition would be to like fucking burn the card.
Yeah.
Like,
well, they were also unhealthy, had mental health issues that I don't know if they've ever addressed, but it's a sickness and they were not the right... The whole point of this is when your relationship with yourself isn't right, you are not going to find the right person. You're not going to choose the right person. You're not going to choose someone who wants the best for you or will bring the best out of you because you don't want that for yourself.
What were they getting out of it? You doing that, you accepting the invitation from that business card. What did they stand to gain from that?
Fetishization.
Really? That was it?
Yeah.
So there wasn't a commercial element or anything like that for them. Do you forgive that person?
No, I forgive myself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think there's a need to forgive people in life?
I think you need to forgive yourself for if someone has crossed your boundary, you need to forgive yourself for letting that happen, for giving them a position in your life to hurt you like that. Me telling you that wasn't to explain or shift blame. It was to give context as to where I was mentally.
How do you, from that point onwards, from 20 years onwards then, for the next couple of years, when you look back at the Mia...
Sarah.
Sarah?
Yeah.
Do you prefer to be called Sarah?
Yeah. Yeah. But it also, it's not, I don't take offense to, I did a while ago, but I don't take offense to it or I don't feel like my name's actually Sarah. Mm-hmm. It's either or.
You prefer to be called Sarah?
I do.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's Sarah through that period of your life, characterized by low self-esteem, people around her capitalizing on that in various different ways, you in your own words, not knowing better at that time in your life. At that point in your life, 20, 21, 22, you go and study, right? So you study at university, again, with the aim of pursuing some kind of academic or professional pursuit. And what was that?
History. Yeah. Didn't really see... Even then, I didn't see like a future doing anything. I just thought I really enjoy studying history. Felt like watching a movie. I'm enamored with it's my favorite subject. It felt like the easiest thing. The second easiest thing is like psychology.
Oh, I love psychology.
Yeah, exactly. They're the interesting ones. They're the juicy, they're the juicy majors. I didn't see myself doing anything other than whatever I had going on the next week. And then I guess the furthest I thought ahead was, I guess I'll work in archives or work in a museum or something. I didn't have a plan like, oh, I want to be a teacher or something.
I've heard you talk about weight loss and weight-related issues attached to the self-esteem conversation. What role did your weight play in all of this and the self-esteem and the confidence and body image issues and all of that?
I think a pretty large one. My weight now still fluctuates. And the more that I've worked on myself in therapy, the less that bothers me and my and affects my relationship with myself. So even in the months where I feel like I do not look like myself, I don't feel like myself, I've let myself go a little bit, it doesn't affect me the way it used to 10 years ago. I don't fall. Yeah, I don't let it get to me as much anymore. But it did for a very long time because it was, I weighed like 60 pounds more than this, which is a lot.
That's a huge amount of weight to lose.
Yeah.
I read that the ways that you lost that weight were slightly troubling.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't eating well. I wasn't exercising well. I had unhealthy habits. I was young.
Therapy. You went to therapy. That's helped you get to where you are today.
Yeah.
What role has therapy played in your life? And when did you first start going to therapy?
Oh, the biggest role. 2016.
Yeah.
The biggest role. I mean, I'm still in therapy. Mm-hmm. I don't see myself ever stopping, really. I cycle out therapists. It's like, yeah. I love it. I love feeling like, okay, I'm ready for a fresh start. I'm ready for someone new. I'm ready for a new perspective. It's a way to keep me grounded. Every week I have to sit down and analyze myself, my thoughts, my past. Like I have to dig down and actually come face to face with the decisions I've made, my ways of thinking, my relationship with myself. Like there's accountability with therapy. And I think that's the biggest impact, I guess, accountability. Yeah.
When you've dug down and sought to understand yourself, what are some of the key takeaways you've taken from therapy? So when I think about that question, if I was to be on the receiving end of it, one of the first things that comes to mind is actually my ongoing evolution of understanding why I was so avoidant in relationships, like always running away from any woman. Even if I pursued her and then she turned and said, okay, let's be boyfriend and girlfriend, I would just bounce. And I had sort of like toxic model of like what love was from my parents, but then also all the shame and insecurities. Like, I think I'm ambitious. No, I'm being dragged by this need to be enough, right? So those are kind of the two top line ideas that I took away from my experience with sort of introspection. Are there any like big picture ideas that you've taken away from therapy that were epiphany moments, connected dots?
That's a loaded question because I'm so grateful for all of the information I've learned about myself, like the dots I've been able to connect, like how being triggered by something a friend of mine says is actually related to the way that I felt ostracized on the playground when no one wanted to play with me. And like one little thing, even though they didn't mean it that way or even had any malicious intent behind it, has then taken me back to that 12-year-old girl who just feels so alone and doesn't know what she did wrong and just wants to people please. And I think the best part of therapy is within a split, yeah, have you seen That's So Raven?
No.
Oh, it's this show with Raven Simone on the Disney Channel when we were growing up. And she has these visions. She's a psychic. And she just like stares off into space and then she zooms out and then she zooms back in and no time has gone. But she saw maybe a 30-minute vision play out. But she comes back and it's been like a split second. And that's what therapy feels like. It takes me back and I analyze that moment and I understand that moment is not this moment and my friend cares about me and she's not actually trying to make me feel like no one wants to play with me on the playground just because she said you can come if you want and not I want you to come, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I think that's the magic behind therapy. It gives you time traveling superpowers.
Has it changed your perception of the period of your life where you enter the adult entertainment industry? Has it changed your perception how you
think? Yeah, absolutely. I spent so much time wondering, why did I do this? This is not me. I was in it for such a short amount of time. And the entire time I was doing it, I was also asking myself every day, why am I doing this? What is wrong with me? What is wrong with me? That's like the number one question. And I know what was wrong with me. I had low self-esteem. I had no boundaries with myself. I didn't respect myself. I didn't like myself. So many things were wrong with me. And all of these things anyone can work on. It's hard. It is hard though. It's hard. Once you become self-aware, there's no going back. I think I cried more in the first 2 years of being in therapy than I ever did going through anything I did in my life, in my adolescence, in my early teens, and anything.
This is why a lot of people don't go to therapy.
It's hard. It's hard. That self-awareness is like, I mean, no. And especially once you start realizing things about people in your life that you've kind of put rose-colored glasses on for all your life, to make up excuses or to kind of change the situation in your head so that you don't actually have to face what the reality was, or the fact that, wow, this is actually a really situation. This person that I love, who's supposed to support me, who's supposed to be there for me, was actually not that great in hindsight, not even in hindsight, in 2020 sight, in actual vision.
And the shedding that takes place when you become
shedding, that's a great good word. Isn't yeah, it? That's accurate, great. That's exactly like how it feels.
Slowly letting these little pieces go. What's interesting is when I read about your life post the adult entertainment industry, which was only a couple of months anyway, all in all, you sounded incredibly isolated. So when I think about the word shedding, I think of all these people that you're letting go. But in that period, you sounded like you were alone. I remember the story of you going to Austin and meeting your friend on Twitter, all those kinds of things. Take me to that period then. So you make the decision that career is not for you. What happens the next, the next day, week, month, post that?
Fucking loneliness. I was living in an efficiency. An efficiency is not even a studio. It's where this rug cuts off to that wall. That is wider than what it was, but definitely the length. My toilet, my bathroom sink was also my kitchen sink. There was no stove. There was a broken window that I had tape over, and there was only one window. It's a room. I think they're popular in South Florida, or like, I don't think you have them here because I don't think they're legal to like sell as living spaces. Very lonely, extremely lonely. But at that point in my life, loneliness was better than what I was doing before. And that, I think, was the start of the tiniest, tiniest, tiniest bit of confidence. That gave me the confidence to take the risk of moving to Austin and starting a new life. And I was so lonely. I was so broke. I was so lost. I was so confused. But all I was completely 100% sure of was I don't want to do porn. I've never wanted to do porn. I'm never going to go back to that. And standing firm on my ground in my morals, in my boundaries, in just everything, that was like the tiniest glimmer of confidence starting to grow. Standing firm in my boundaries, even if I didn't know that was a boundary. I couldn't pinpoint it. I couldn't call it that. I didn't know what it was. I didn't have the verbiage or the knowledge or the self-awareness to call it what it was, but that was how it started. If I hadn't moved to Austin, I wouldn't have started therapy. I wouldn't have, that was the domino effect of, in a positive way in my life. Mm-hmm. It could have gone a completely other way, and it does for so many people. And I'm so, so, so grateful that I was able to get out.
That first domino falling, which took you to Austin in that new direction, was there a catalyst? Was there something that pushed that domino? Because I noticed that in the sort of timeline of events, you then at the same time separate from your partner around a similar time, and then you leave the adult entertainment industry. Was there a catalyst? Because those two decisions are huge decisions, and they feel correlated. They feel like they're attached.
I had nothing to lose, and I think that I also knew I need to get the fuck out of Miami. I was in Miami at the time, and it was where everything happened. And I just did not want to be there anymore. It felt daunting. It felt like walls closing in on me everywhere I went.
Was there like a catalyst day though? Something that happens that makes you go, fuck, I need to, or was it just slowly?
Yeah, it was, I mean, it was the day I met my best friend on Twitter. I didn't meet her that day on Twitter. Her and I had been following each other for a while. She posts memes. I like them, vice versa. Her and I were talking about something. Oh, she said, I'm looking for a roommate. I'm asking around the office for a roommate. And I said, what if I move to Austin? I don't want to live in Miami anymore. And then I started looking up, how do you move states? Like, what does it take? What does it require? What paperwork do I need for my dogs? Like all of that stuff. And then within a month, I was packed up and moved.
And was there a catalyst for you deciding to leave the adult entertainment industry, even though you were there for a couple of months? Was there anything?
I think it was how overwhelming everything became so fast.
Ah, okay.
Like that was the reality check. When they turn the lights on at the club at 4 a.m, like, whoa, the floors are sticky and nothing looks the same. This is not what I signed up for. It's not what I expected. I fucked up.
That's not a typical experience for an actress in that industry.
No, not at all.
That is a very atypical experience because you went from obscurity to number one in an industry in weeks.
Yeah.
So you got hit by a fucking truck.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense. Okay. You become a paralegal?
Yeah, for a very short period of time. Like 6 months.
Tell me all about that.
Nothing really much to say. It was for an insurance defense firm. It was pretty boring and it was very much like corporate. The insurance company that they represented was Geico. So it was like a very boring thing. And it was just paper pushing. It was really weird to work there, especially since that was my first job where I did it. I did the application and I went into it thinking this is the shift. This is me putting Mia Khalifa behind me. And this is me like trying to be a real human. Did not work. Everyone in the office recognized me. It was a very uncomfortable work environment. Not because anyone was overtly inappropriate. It was just simply being in an office, knowing anyone who walked through did a double take and is like, are you? So that was uncomfortable. And then after that, I worked at a construction company just doing bookkeeping and office work. And same thing, I would have to go on a job site. And the owner of the company just made it so I can't go on job sites. It was a distraction. It was not a good idea. It was, people would be that, in that situation, people would be inappropriate sometimes. But yeah, I started to feel like a burden in the offices where I was. And I hated that feeling. And I was actually sitting at that construction job in the office when I was talking to Rachel in the DMs, like, I'm going to move to Austin. Let's do it.
Anxiety.
Yeah.
Has that been a big part of your life for much of your life?
Yes, very much so. And I think that has been prevalent from the very beginning.
The very beginning as in since you were a kid or a teenager? Or...
Yeah, probably even in utero. I mean, my parents grew up in the Civil War in Lebanon. And I lived through a lot of conflict in Lebanon, whether it be civil or the surrounding countries or whatever. But we left for a reason and it's because it was dangerous. So I think I've always had that. Like I jump when I hear a noise. I jump when someone who's been in the room for 4 hours with me speaks, even though they haven't spoken in 10 minutes. Like I get scared. Like I'm a jumpy person, probably because of that.
When was your anxiety at its highest?
2019, 2020.
Okay. So that's post Austin.
Oh yeah, yeah. It was when it was post everything, but it was in the midst of the porn company going after me publicly and re-releasing things and digging up footage that was corrupted in 2013, whenever it was shot, and releasing it like it was new, and that coming back into the news cycle and them just being extremely abusive and exerting and proving that they still have control over me because I signed a contract that says in perpetuity on it.
Your life had started to move.
Oh yeah. I was married again.
You were married again, 2019. Where are you living at this point in time?
I was living in LA.
LA.
I was living in LA. I was doing my own thing. I was starting to figure out what it was I wanted to do and where I want, like things were really good that year. It was the year I had that little cameo in that incredible show, Rami. That was a huge moment for me. And I'm so grateful for that moment. And I'm so upset that that moment was kind of overshadowed by all of the negativity that came from the porn company in the subsequent months.
The porn company coming after you and attacking you. Not something you would expect from a company.
A $1 billion company at that. Yeah, it goes to show you how petty and personal it is, because the people who are behind it aren't exactly the CEOs. It's the bored pseudo producers who don't like that I'm out here talking about my experience. It's very much individuals, not the company, but these individuals do have the power to speak on the company's behalf.
What are they threatened by?
I think they're threatened by, like you said earlier, most people in my position aren't in my position because this is the outcome that the girls want who enter the industry, most of them who enter the commercial porn industry or the mainstream porn industry. They want the fame. They want the infamy. They want all of that. And I think for the first time, these individuals are experiencing someone who is fully aware of what was happening and is fully aware of what is and isn't ethical and has the platform and the resources to speak on all of those things.
What is your opinion of the industry now?
I have a very unfavorable opinion on it, but I do think that there are ethical and unethical ways that you can support sex workers and consume porn. As someone who is a creator or as someone who is simply a consumer, there are ethical ways to do it. Granted, any company has its downsides, like even OnlyFans has trouble policing and regulating the people who are on their site. And every company has its downsides, but I would say that the major production porn companies are all predatory and abusive and unethical and prey on vulnerable young women. And even me saying this, I already know that some of the responses back are going to be from women in the industry that say, no, it's not. No, it's not. It's great. It's fantastic. Everyone is so nice. I love this company. I love all of this. And to be honest with you, I think that that rhetoric is grooming. I think that if you're going to enter the industry and you're going to be an advocate for it, it has to come with a caveat. And that caveat needs to be, you shouldn't enter the industry unless you've already kind of been in the industry. It shouldn't be a first option for you. Like, that shouldn't be something that you simply go into because you like it. Think about it more. Wait on it more. The age to go into the industry should not be 18. You're putting contracts in front of 18-year-old girls that have the words in perpetuity on them. Do you know how dangerous and predatory that is? These are 3, 4, 5-page contracts.
Jesus Christ. I mean, any contract when you're 18 years old, although it's like reading a
the
different
legal
language.
Verb, it's yeah. Jargon. It's literally another language.
Yeah. I was thinking about Miranda rights. We don't really have like Miranda rights. We have our own version of it here. But you
what do you do, sing God Save the Queen?
I don't know. I've never been arrested. I'll let you know. but you get read your Miranda. I watch all of these like US crime interrogation videos. It's like How I Fall Asleep. Don't worry about it.
Wow.
But I see them
being
read.
Let's go back to anxiety.
yeah. I see them being read their Miranda rights before they get interrogated and then they get offered a lawyer.
Yeah.
Seems like maybe from what you're saying, that's not a bad idea.
No.
If there was some kind of like implications clearly stated to people that are considering entering the porn industry at a young age and the opportunity to have a lawyer or at least legal representation to impartially explain as a third party the potential implications for better or for worse. You know,
I don't think that's ever going to be possible unless the laws change around what around the rights that they have. It's just those two words, in perpetuity.
In perpetuity. What vicious words.
Yeah. Not forever. Not in your lifetime. Not in our lifetime. In perpetuity of all lifetimes in all existence. Who needs that much control over a young woman's body?
They still own the website with your name, with your...
Yeah.
There's nothing you can do to have that website taken down?
I mean, there is, but it's a very expensive lawsuit against a billion-dollar corporation. It's a conglomerate. They also own... Bang Bros isn't the only company under that umbrella. It's a very wide reach.
The peak of your anxiety, 2019, 2020. If I was a fly on the wall inside your apartment, wherever you were living back then, what would I have seen? What would I have observed?
Didn't shower, didn't brush my teeth, didn't eat, didn't leave my bed, was crying all the time. Anytime I would open my phone, I felt like a prisoner in my own body and in the world, more so, not just in my own body, because I couldn't scream loud enough. There's nothing I could do to make it go away or to make them stop. Honestly, the worst part about it was I knew that if I went on and actually spoke about how much it impacted me, that's what they would want. That's exactly what they would want. They were very annoyed that I started naming them by name, and that's when everything started. These individuals value their privacy more than anything in the world, and it's because of all of the unethical and immoral things that they've done throughout their careers in this industry. So they all go by aliases too. Being called out by their legal government names was not something they took kindly to, and that is why they chose to release the video that the footage was corrupted of 10 years ago.
That was a pornographic video. Released. Okay, so they started releasing more videos because you were speaking out against them. And they started doing a variety of other attacks, making like mini Instagram documentary clips of you, which you'd expect like a jealous, bitter ex to be doing something like that.
That's exactly what they are.
You know, not a corporation.
That's exactly what they are, a jealous, bitter ex.
I look at all the decisions I've made in my life, and I think about, you know, being 18 and deciding to do this or that, or 25 and doing this and fucking up at that. And people look back and they say, there's always a silver lining. Is there a silver lining?
Yeah. I'm really funny. Trauma makes you funny. Builds character. No, of course there's a silver lining. I'm sitting in front of you today, happier than I've ever been. I am not the sum of the things I've been through or the adversities I've faced. I'm not. The silver lining is it fucking happened. It's over with. It's not over with, actually. It's following me for the rest of my life. But I am no longer in the mental space that I was back then. So it's over with for me.
And you get to make your silver lining.
Yeah.
And that's what I feel like you've done, is you've made a silver lining. Because there's clearly, you could have gone several ways.
Yes, that's true.
What are the ways you could have gone?
I was acting on instinct. There wasn't a time when I sat down and thought, what do I want with my life? I needed a job, so I acted on instinct. I applied to things that I felt like I could do. I'm good at paperwork. I'm good at just administrative things. I like being left alone, so I didn't want a job where I was working with... I was always acting on instinct. There was never really a plan. What felt right? It felt right in the moment to get an office job. It felt right in the moment to leave that one and go to another one. It felt right in the moment to leave everything and move to Austin. It felt right in the moment in Austin to... Well, actually, I had a very... That was the first time in my life where I started forming a core group of friends and people who are still in my life to this day. And they were the ones who convinced me, not convinced me, but kind of encouraged me to go to therapy.
You'll know if you've listened to the last few episodes of this podcast, we're now sponsored by the incredible Whoop. And if you're anything like me and juggling a fair few things every day, Whoop could be a real game changer in your life. When I was a young entrepreneur, I liked to I think, talk a little bit too much about how many hours that I worked, how many emails I'd sent, and all of those kinds of things. But I didn't have a second thought on how all of that work and that workaholism was impacting my stress levels, my productivity, my sleep, my overall health, which is why I think the new stress monitoring feature on my Whoop is so important. Whoop is this small device on my wrist that I wear during the podcast. It's a wearable health and fitness coach and helps you to sleep better, to train harder, live healthier, and now manage your stress. One of the ways that it does this is with scientifically backed breathing exercises developed with leading neuroscientist, Dr. Andrew Huberman. If you're someone who's struggling to manage and overcome stress, I'd highly recommend you check out Whoop. It's been a genuine game changer for me. Go to join.whoop.com/CEO to get a free month's Whoop membership on me and let me know how you get on.
I'm in an interesting phase at the moment in my fitness and health journey because I'm training for Soccer Aid, which takes place in June at Old Trafford. I've been training a lot differently, but regardless of how I train, regardless of whether I'm doing strength training or cardiovascular training, which is predominantly what I'm doing now, I need this, which is Huel's nutritionally complete protein product. The crazy thing about this, which I almost find hard to achieve, is that it's 20 grams of protein. You get 26 vitamins and minerals, and it's only roughly about 100 calories, 105 calories. And it tastes like a dream. The salted caramel one is my favorite. I've got the second favorite option of mine in front of me, which is vanilla fudge. Both of them taste amazing. A little bit of ice in it. It tastes like a fantastic, healthy milkshake. Give it a try. If you haven't already, this is actually, next to RTD, this is my favorite product from Huel. It's the product that I use the most from Huel. Try it. Love it. Number one protein powder.
Depression. Another word. Different to anxiety in many respects. Yeah. People often characterize it with like thoughts of the past and they think of anxiety as worries of the future. Depression's another word that I read a few times throughout your story. Again, is that something that's kind of been with you throughout life, or was that post moving to Miami?
It was really that 2019, 2020.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. I went on Lexapro. That was when, I mean, maybe I was depressed, but it was never diagnosed. I had two therapy sessions a week and a psychiatrist, and I was on Lexapro, I was on propranolol, I was on beta blockers, everything for anxiety, depression, all of that. All of that was in 2019, 2020, when everything started to kind of get rehashed, and I felt like I'm very, very grateful to be out of the depths of my depression. But something that does keep me up at night, anxiety-wise, is where things are headed with AI and deep fakes and things like that. Because that feeling of being violated all over again and having no control, like it's like trying to run in a dream. As hard as you try, it's impossible, and it's a very daunting feeling, and you feel claustrophobic and you feel like you're trying to breathe underwater and all of these really, really awful things that are out of your control. That's what that feels like. And I try not to think about it for too long, but.
The AI stuff feels like that and the deepfake stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it's fucking terrifying.
Yeah.
Were people worried about you 2019? Did you have people around you that were worried about you at that point?
I did. I'm very grateful I did.
Because I'm trying to think of the step people take when they go and have therapy or they go to the doctor and say, listen, something's wrong with me. You're at home. This stuff's happening online. This porn company are targeting you. What was the catalyst in that moment to make you go, do you know what? I need to go get help.
Oh, I was still in therapy. Yeah. And my therapist said, you need a psychiatrist.
Really?
Yeah. He said, I'm you need a psychiatrist. I can't prescribe you antidepressants. You need a psychiatrist. Here's some recommendations.
Again, so what's life like? I joined a TV show. So things changed for me. You know, people start stopping you in the street and coming up to you in the gym and stuff. And, you know, it comes with the territory of what I did. I was well aware of what I was getting into. Also, I joined the TV show when I was like 28, 29. So you kind of like, you're probably a bit more prepared mentally for things and you understand the world a bit better and you're not trying to impress people as much as I was when I was younger. But it was still an adjustment, to say the least. What was life like for you that post-Miami period? You're now moving on with your life. You're trying to, you know, this porn company come for you. What is life like day to day when you go to the coffee shop?
I'm kind of glad you asked that because it's a huge contrast to what it is now. Even though it's kind of still the same, I would get recognized and I would get come up to and I would get asked to like take a photo with someone all the time. But my reaction to it is completely different than it is now. I would want to crawl into a hole and hide away and be ashamed. I was so embarrassed. I felt like a warm feeling in my stomach, like I had just been punched or like I just found out I was being cheated on or something. Like it's just a very painful, visceral reaction to be recognized and to know what you're being recognized for. And it wasn't until I started to accomplish other things and I started to be proud of things that I've done and things that I've kind of shifted and diverted into in my career. So those first few months to a year in Austin, I had a lot of social anxiety and I didn't go out much because I didn't want to be recognized. I felt like I just didn't want to be recognized. I didn't want to be looked at. I didn't want to be perceived. I didn't want to leave my house. None of that. But
is that a form of like self-hatred? Because you're like,
because it was more so the people who were coming up to me, college guys, like men, you know, it just made me uncomfortable because I knew why they knew me. And it wasn't until I started accomplishing things that I was actually proud of that that changed. I didn't feel that same like gut-wrenching, visceral feeling of shame when I would hear the name Mia or get called in the street or anything like that. Like the more I accomplished, the more proud I was of what I've built and what I've changed and all of these things that I've done, the more comfortable I got with being recognized because inherently people were recognizing me for other things. Women started to recognize me. Everything kind of shifted. The more that I do and continue to do, the more that changes. Like I rarely get come, like I get come up to more by women now than by men. And I love that.
What was that path out of the, there's a book from a psychiatrist I had on this podcast called The Path Out of the Jungle. For you, what was the, that's path through the jungle, sorry, but what was the path out of the jungle for you, that 2019 depression period? Like how did you, for people that might be in that situation right now where they're really struggling, was it just time? Was it community support? Was it the medication? How did you get out of that phase?
Everything. All of that combined, truly. I don't think I could have done it without, shout out to Lexapro, without the Lexapro, without my support system, without my job, without people in my job encouraging me to pursue what I want to do and to not let fear of having something taken away from me or having something.
You had that fear of having it taken away from you?
Yeah, of course. Of course. They're constantly threatening me even using the name Mia Khalifa.
They're threatening you using the name Mia Khalifa?
They think they have ownership of it.
Okay.
Which they do not. It's my dog's name. And they tried to convince me not to use Khalifa because they said, no one's going to know how to spell it. But yeah, I'm constantly in fear of, they're a billion-dollar corporation.
Yeah, it's, yeah.
The amount of lawsuits that they field on a daily basis. They're being sued right now by a company that does MLB trading cards because they're trying to do trading cards of actresses.
You're married around that time, right? 2019?
Yeah.
A lot of what I read said that marriage had fallen apart because the attention you were getting was difficult for your partner.
I don't know about that. He's also
famous.
No. Well, he's a very popular chef.
Okay.
But no, that was more of irreconcilable differences. No, I'm just kidding. It was a lot. We were in therapy for a year.
Okay.
An entire year. We tried. We were separated for 3 months. I lived at an Airbnb. I moved out of the house. Like we tried. It was more so, it just very much came down to, we got married very too early. We got married too soon before we actually knew each other. We got married in the honeymoon phase and we were just very different.
TikTok.
Yes.
You've become a TikTok sensation. I don't like to spend too much time on TikTok because, you know, I'll end up not doing anything with my life if I spend too long on there because it's really addictive. But I went through your TikToks. You're a comedian.
Oh my God. It's the trauma.
No, but you are. You're incredibly successful on TikTok.
I think that TikTok is my favorite app. And I think that I'm very lucky that TikTok is just, it's where I spend the most time. I kind of just get it. It was very easy for me. I love TikTok. So
suits your personality.
Yeah.
You've cultivated a group of people there, a huge group of people, almost like 30 million people or something crazy, who love that side of Sarah.
Yeah. The women on my TikTok are amazing. I'm very, very grateful for the community of women that I found on there.
A second ago, you said about 10 years time, plans for 10 years time. You said now you have an answer.
Mm.
What is the answer?
The answer is 2-car garage, decent backyard, 3 very successful, still operating companies that I'm very heavily involved in still. I don't plan on retiring anytime soon. And hopefully a kid on the way.
Ooh. In order to have a kid. Now, there's a couple of routes to having a kid.
That's not true.
In order to have a kid, you can adopt one, you can steal one, or you can have your own. All of these paths. I mean, I'm sure there might be a fourth path that I'm not thinking
about. Yeah, I wouldn't mind stealing a 4-year-old, someone who's already like into cartoons and stuff. So maybe that's the route I go for.
Are you in a relationship now?
No.
You're single?
Yes.
How are you finding that? I talk a lot about my guests about relationships and how dating in the modern world is really, really tough.
It is tough.
It sucks, especially for a certain generation that I think got caught between like the digital world and like the analog world.
Yeah.
Do you find it tough? Obviously, people know who you are. You're famous. You're super famous. You've got like 60 million followers plus. Do you find it tough to date?
Very. Very, but I'm also not trying. I've been a serial monogamist for a while. I got out of a long-ish term relationship few months ago. But yeah, it's difficult. It's difficult, but I also haven't tried, but I don't know what I'm expecting. I haven't gone into the dating world in maybe 6 years. I've been in long-term relationships.
What would make a great partner for Sarah? What would they have to have? What would be the jigsaw shape?
Emotional intelligence and a good relationship with their therapist and with therapy in general. Someone who's constantly working on themselves and is self-aware and understands the ebbs and flows of life and emotions and how it's not always going to be even keel, how it'll oscillate. But oscillate doesn't necessarily mean go from good to toxic. It means go from good to needing a little more support than you normally have.
Men are not necessarily the best at emotional intelligence, but I think
I'm not ruling out women.
Yeah, good. And business. 3 businesses. The business, the jewelry brand. Can you tell me all about your jewelry brand and the inspiration for that and your vision for that?
I'm really, really excited to launch it. It's called Shaitan. The inspiration is every woman who I've ever admired, every Arab girl who chooses yellow gold over white gold, every just women in general, huge inspiration behind it. It's body jewelry for the most part, but it's also lifestyle. It will launch imminently. And yeah.
Why did you choose jewelry?
Because I love it. I was custom making the things that I wanted that I couldn't find easily. Hand lariats and foot lariats and belly chains and bra chains and all of this stuff was extremely hard to find. So I was custom making it and paying a lot for it. So I'm very excited to put out something that is extremely delicate and precious and beautiful, but also affordable.
You know, when you think about like the ingredients list of your own happiness right now in your life, what is on that list of ingredients? What are the like factors that need to be present for you to feel like stable and full?
Mm. I would say 70% alone time.
Interesting.
20% time surrounded by people who energize and recharge me, and 10% just 10% fuck it. 10% just if something feels right, do it. Follow your instinct. But like, I'm kind of scared of my instinct a little too sometimes, even though, yeah, 10% just listen to your gut.
And going back to the start of the conversation, this is because you feel closest to knowing who you are?
Yeah. Yeah. The most secure in the decisions I make on a daily basis.
And who are you?
I'm Sarah. I'm Sarah fucking Joe.
And who's Sarah Joe?
Sarah is unapologetic and not fearless, pretty fearful, but I think that's a good thing. Cautious. Cautious and secure.
Okay, so unapologetic. And then the second one was not fearless, pretty fearful.
Yeah, but in a good way. Cautious, cautious.
Cautious, okay. Yeah. The unapologetic part. I get that. I sense that from you. Where did that come from?
Rihanna.
Rihanna. No, really, that came from Rihanna.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. She has a whole album called Unapologetic. And that is what I base my personality off of.
Why?
What do you mean why?
Why did you choose to bait? There's so many different albums Rihanna's made. Or,
oh, that's the one that just exudes. That's the one that kind of, that was her shift also. That was her moment of, now I know who I am and I'm unapologetic about it. It might not be the bubblegum pop girl you thought I was or wanted me to be. This is who I am. And this is the person who's not going anywhere.
Is that a stark contrast from the Sarah I would have met had I met you at like 18? Like, I want to, if I like put that 18-year-old Sarah there and I had them both side by side, I'm guessing Sarah 18 wouldn't be unapologetic.
No.
What can you describe how her vibe would have been sat here today?
Shriveled, insecure.
Oh, really?
Quiet, probably. Or too loud, just because insecurity screams. Not someone. Well, actually, no, that is someone who I would want to be around because I feel empathy for her. And I forgive her.
And the journey to unapologetic was, from what I've garnered so far, based on the evidence you got from going out and doing things and proving shit to yourself.
Yeah.
That's so important. I was going to say this at the start of the conversation, this idea of confidence. People don't know how you said it, like, how the fuck do you get confidence? Like, where does it come from? How do I buy one? But from your own experiences, it's the evidence you gain from doing shit that changes your beliefs.
Exactly.
It's all evidence.
Yeah.
You have evidence for, like, low confidence is negative evidence.
Yeah.
And the confidence you've built over the last couple of years is from doing really cool shit.
Yeah, exactly.
We have a closing tradition on this podcast where the last guest leaves a question for the next guest.
Okay.
And they leave it written in this diary.
Oh.
Aristotle said, give me the child at 7 and I'll show you the man or woman. Is it true that the first 7 years of your life make you who you are?
I think they have a huge impact, just psychology speaking, psychologically. I think those are very formative years. Yeah.
7 years old, you could have whispered some words into Sarah's ear. What would those words have been?
You're amazing. You're enough. You're perfect.
Thank you so much, ma'am.
Thank you.
Sarah.
Yeah, that's okay.
Learning about your story and really like the reaction to the mistakes you made when you were younger is incredibly inspiring for me, because we all make decisions, especially in our younger years, that, you know, through naivety or other or coercion or whatever it might be, we're not necessarily, you know, we wouldn't make those decisions again. And the way you've responded to that and built the life that you're building now off the back of that, and the audience you've built around TikTok and social media, around your personality and your humor, is incredibly hope inspiring. It gives me a lot of hope that regardless of, you know, the steps I make in my life, there will be, there's a way through, there's a way through the jungle. And that's what your story represents to me. It's an incredibly inspiring one. And you're an inspiration for that very reason.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that.
As you might know, this podcast is now sponsored by the incredible Airbnb. And Airbnb have saved me many, many times whenever I'm working away or on business trips or on holidays. But have you ever thought about whether your home could be an Airbnb when you're away on business or on holiday, or even just a part of your home? Let me explain. Maybe your roommate is moving out and you're thinking about what to do with the extra space. Or maybe you have a spare bedroom that you've never used. You could Airbnb it and make some extra cash for bills or to pay for anything in your life, holidays, or just for some extra money. I've Airbnb'd my place previously, and honestly, the process couldn't have been easier. It's something I'd highly recommend you all to check out. Your extra room, that extra space you have in your house, you might be surprised how much it's worth. I was surprised how much it was worth. And you can find out how much it's worth by going to airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Check it out. You got to the end of this podcast. Whenever someone gets to the end of this podcast, I feel like I owe them a greater debt of gratitude, because that means you listened to the whole thing. And hopefully that suggests that you enjoyed it. If you are at the end and you enjoyed this podcast, could you do me a little bit of a favor and hit that subscribe button? That's one of the clearest indicators we have that this episode was a good episode. And we look at that on all of the episodes to see which episodes generated the most subscribers. Thank you so much, and I'll see you again next time.